That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Ah.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, and thanks to elderly gentlemen for a very lively Saturday night. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Roy. I'm Kevin Day, and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, how does an accountant of your calibre celebrate an election result like that? Did you crack open a spreadsheet or two?
Well, I did. I've been monitoring all the states one by one, counting the votes as they came in. So, I did get quite giddy, and I was doing standard deviations on it, and many deviations on it actually when Joe Biden won.
Yeah, I haven't watched CNN for quite some time. I've never seen so-called bipartisan newscasters so happy about an election result. It was quite amusing, and obviously I was very happy about the election result, but in a childish, immature way, not as happy about Palace beating Leeds 4-1. It's questions day, Kieran. I'm sorry to mention football. I know it's a painful subject for you at the moment, Kieran. I can just about see the top of your head from how far up the table we are. And I realise it's probably something you've heard before. I shouldn't have said that. It's questions day, Kieran. A lot of people have seen the top of your head is what I'm guessing, Kieran. It's questions day, but of course we have some news stories for you. And firstly, Kieran Maguire, congratulations to Marcus Rashford.
Yes, Marcus had a conversation with the Prime Minister yesterday, and the government has agreed to support, I think, two of the main issues that Marcus has been campaigning for. And this isn't a time for party political point scoring, anything of that nature. I think it's a step in the right direction. I think the government's made the right decision, and you've got to give a huge amount of kudos to Marcus Rashford for continuing to fight for what he believes in, yeah, in terms of giving kids support and giving them food. And we've had this discussion on more than one occasion in a modern democracy such as the UK. For a successful economy, every child is entitled to three square meals a day. And if the government can help, then hats off to them as well.
Yeah, and also fair play to Marcus for, as you just said, acknowledging the government's change of mind and thanking them for it, which is a good thing to do. There are occasions when I almost feel sorry for Boris Johnson, because every time he phones somebody like Marcus Rashford, they just put the phone down thinking it's a joke. It's somebody trying to do a Boris Johnson voice, and poor old Boris has to call back again and go, no, it really is me. But yeah, congratulations to Marcus Rashford for that. And he is going to continue his campaign, but for children and parents to know that they will be fed for the next nearly 2 years is a great achievement. And the Premier League's pay-per-view model, Kieran, is looking likely to be ditched during lockdown, although broadcasters are claiming they couldn't do it this weekend because too many people had already subscribed, which may well have been true for Palace Leeds, but can't have been so for Brighton Burnley, surely.
No, I would be amazed if many people had bought into that. We have seen that some of the viewing figures were in four figures only. So to get, you know, just single thousands, it isn't a great level of support. And that's not clearly neutrals wouldn't have paid for it for any price, I suspect. But even sort of committed Brighton and Burnley fans, I didn't buy it. I chose to listen to the radio. Speaking to, you know, the people that I'm connected with in the WhatsApp groups and so on, nobody was prepared to do it. And the consensus was it's not the principle. We understand that you shouldn't get something for nothing necessarily, although it's nice, of course. It purely came down to the price, and it is a ridiculous price for a match taking place at 5:30 on a Friday evening between two clubs in the bottom six, who the last two or three times they played each other have never had more than one or two goals in the match, and mainly zero.
Yeah, I think the 5:30 thing is something that's kind of been overlooked in the discussion, because it's probably as untraditional a time as you can get for English football fans, isn't it? I mean, we're used to traipsing around the country for various nighttime kickoffs and occasional early Sunday kickoffs, but 5:30 on a Friday evening is a strange time to ask people to pay for money. But this, do you think the pay-per-view is definitely going to be stopped during lockdown, Kieran? And could they keep, I mean, BT Sport are very bullish about the fact that they couldn't cancel games this week, give them for nothing because people had subscribed. I'm guessing some people will have already subscribed to most of the games that were due to come at £14.95. So they could use that excuse to not do it at all, couldn't they? Not get rid of it at all.
They could, but remember the broadcasters and the Premier League had only come to an arrangement for the end of this weekend. And we've got a nice natural break, isn't there, in the sense it's an international week, although I think a lot of people will be scratching their heads as to why on earth are international friendlies taking place in Europe, forcing players to travel the length and breadth of the continent for matches which have absolutely no meaning. So that does seem bizarre. But when you look into the small print, it's all being driven by the fact that individual football associations don't want to have to give even more rebates to broadcasters. And money is behind all of this. So in terms of where we're going to go forwards, we're not going to have pay-per-view at £14.95. That's the only one thing, I think, of which we are absolutely certain. It could come in at a lower price. It could come in effectively free if you are a Sky or BT or Amazon or a subscriber. Or of course, you've got a TV license and one match might end up on BBC. Or it could be complete blackout. So, you know, the alternatives have not yet been decided, which does seem a bit strange, because you would have thought that club chief executives have had plenty of time now to get their minds around this. Is this because there's no consensus as far as the 20 club owners are concerned in the Premier League?
Yeah, and in terms of international football, Kieran, as well, I mean, this is not a story we need to discuss, but it's been announced in the last hour that the England-Iceland game will probably be cancelled because Iceland are due to play in Denmark 3 days beforehand. And, of course, no travel is being allowed from Denmark to the UK because the mink is starting to spread COVID now, which is all getting very surreal. But that's another reason, as you say, why it seems very odd that footballers are dashing across Europe and across the world to play meaningless friendlies and meaningless competitions. But good news for a team here, Kieran, is that Sheffield Wednesday had a real six-pointer this weekend.
Yes, I think if there's not one already, Sheffield Wednesday fans should be campaigning for a statue of Nick DiMarco, their lawyer, who has, first of all, he successfully defended the executives of the club when they were charged by the EFL much earlier this year. Then when the EFL were looking for a 21-point deduction, he got that down to 12 points and delayed for at least one season. And now that 12 points has been reduced to 6. And this is all connected with the sale of Hillsborough to a company called Sheffield 3 Limited, which is also owned by Sheffield Wednesday, Dejan Chansiri. And Mr. Chansiri, if I presume only Wednesday fans would probably have watched this, he gave a three-hour press conference. I think it was on Thursday morning. And you know, fair play to him for facing the press. We had a long list of questions and he was very patient. And he was saying that, as far as he was concerned, it was a legitimate transaction. The aim was to generate profits for the club, and EFL rules allow that, so he couldn't see what all the fuss was about.
Is this the end of it, Kieran, or would you think they'll try and get the other 6 points taken away as well?
They'll be looking to see the small print of the verdict in terms of the points reduction to see what the final decision was based on. Looking at the press statement from the EFL, they are somewhat Trumpian-like, saying, well, you know, the principle of getting the sale in the right year or the wrong year was upheld, so therefore we still count this as a victory. So could they choose to appeal? We don't know. Could Sheffield Wednesday appeal again? I think it's, you know, unlikely, but unlikely is not the same as impossible. They must be feeling very bullish, and I'm sure all Wednesday fans will be delighted. And it'll be a positive from Gary Monk's point of view as well, because it's effectively they've just had two victories, without playing football. So, yeah, that will have a positive impact upon the dressing room. My understanding is that, again, listening to the chairman's statement, the owner's statement the other day, that there are clauses in terms of player wages should the club be relegated to League One. So, you know, the players will be absolutely delighted with this.
Yeah, and we can't talk about Sheffield Wednesday, Kieran, without talking about Derby County. I feel I should burst into song. Hello, Derby, my old friend. We can't get through a pod without Derby County, but there's some good news for once for Derby County fans, which will be taking them aback, because their potential takeover by an Abu Dhabi consortium has been approved by the EFL. This seems to have come somewhat out of the blue, Kieran.
Yes, I mean, the story was first broken by some of the guys in the press just over a week ago. So Derby County are potentially going to be taken over by a company called Derventio Holdings. Derventio Holdings is very much a shell company. It presently has precisely £1 in its bank account and one share, which is fairly standard. It will get funding to acquire Derby County Football Club or Gellor Law 203, or, you know, some of there's about 10 companies have sprung up around Derby County in recent times. My understanding of the deal is worth around about £60 million. Now, I'm assuming that would include the stadium, although remember the stadium was sold for £80 million in 2018 to another company owned by Derby owner Mel Morris. So, you know, perhaps he's just selling it at a bit of a discount because he's decided he's taken the club as far as he can. He's certainly put a lot of money into the company. But we don't know the exact details. We don't know a number of Derby County fans have been in contact with me on Twitter saying, what are the implications for financial fair play? This won't give them an additional advantage, unfortunately, because it's the football club that's assessed for FFP, now known as profitability and sustainability rules, rather than the owner. How bad the accounts are, we still don't know. And again, this one seems a little bit strange because you wouldn't go into a £60 million takeover or however big it is unless you think the accounts have been audited. And if the accounts have been audited, then why the hell haven't Derby County published them? Mm. We've seen this week Grimsby Town publish theirs, Norwich City have published theirs. So there's no excuse for Derby not publishing their 2019 accounts if other clubs are getting their 2020 ones out.
And a final news story before we get on to some very, very good questions this week. Mamadou Sakho has received an apology and a substantial sum of damages from the World Anti-Doping Agency after winning a libel case in the High Court.
Yes, and I think this is an excellent piece of news, first of all, for Mr. Sakho. It did impact on his ability to play in Euro 2016 when there were allegations made by WADA in relation to medication that he'd had, which at the time, I believe, was on the approved list, although I think it subsequently became disapproved. But if you do something which is at the time is within the rules, then it's within the rules. So I believe he was putting in a claim for somewhere in the region of £16 million. Whether he's received the full amount is yet unknown. But I think the important thing is that his name has been cleared. We are quite puritanical when it comes to football in terms of players being clean. It's not like American franchise sport. I've just been reading a book about one of the NFL teams in the 80s where it was just cocaine non-stop. It was ridiculous the amount of narcotics that were being consumed within that particular sport at the time, and the authorities turned a blind eye. But we've always had taken a fairly harsh approach to inappropriate substance use within football. So yeah, fair play to Mamadou Sakho. He's fought his case. He's won, and good luck to him.
Yeah, I've long been an advocate of having two Olympics, one drug-free and one for taking as many drugs as you want, basically. We all know where everyone stands. Just before we start the questions, Kieran, this is a little lesson. I know we have a lot of people listening to us who want to be accountants when they grow up, which is lovely. Should anybody out there want to be the host of a podcast when they grow up, this is a lesson not to start doing your script halfway through a champagne binge after Palace and Joe Biden have won, because I've written some names down here because I got involved in a WhatsApp conversation last night, Kieran, with other Palace fans, one of whom it started with, isn't it a shame that Eric Young wasn't in the same Palace team as Scott Dan and Jordan Much? Because these are the words I've written down. We could have sung Dan too much, much too young. I just... And obviously, I've written it over one of my... No, anyway, never mind. This is a small... our first question, Kieran, comes from Temba Dube. Temba, I apologise if I've mispronounced your name. I'm aware that I'm rapidly turning into the Paul Merson of this podcast. Temba, is there a concept similar to FFP in the women's game in England? Temba says, I'm concerned that the bigger clubs like City and Chelsea seem to be hoovering up talent with impunity, and have wondered if this growth, in inverted commas, is regulated separately to the men's game.
Well, yes, there are financial fair play rules in the women's game. I had a hunt around the FA website and various other sources yesterday. What we've got in the WSL is what's referred to as a soft cap, and here, no more than 40% of the revenue of a WSL club can go on player wages. Now, that's quite low compared to what we've seen historically in places such as League Two and League One, because those were 60% and 50% respectively. Having said that, you wouldn't expect the cap to be exceeded in theory. I've spoken to some of my colleagues who are far more familiar with the WSL than I have, and they said that the average salary in the WSL is £27,000 a year. Ooh. Now, I suspect that some of these stars that have come in from the States will be on substantially more than that. But again, looking at the small print, it looks as if a player can come into the club and perhaps of two roles, so that they can be a player and they could be a liaison officer, you know, in terms of getting local schools more interested in women's football, in doing some of the marketing of the game and so on. And that part of the salary wouldn't count towards the cap. So there is a cap. The reason why I think these stars within the WSL have come into the clubs, such as Chelsea, Arsenal and Manchester City, is because the clubs themselves are very keen to develop the women's side of the game. I think the players want to be part of that journey as well. And the clubs are having sort of deals which are actually starting to make WSL more lucrative. We've seen only in the course of the last couple of weeks that Everton ladies, they've announced a shirt sponsorship deal with a sponsor that is independent of the men's sponsor. So this is a way of generating extra money there as well.
Yeah, Nobby Clark is a loyal and long-standing listener who's asked us questions before, unless there are several Nobby Clarks, in which case it could be a completely different one. But Nobby's question this week, how were Villa able to spend close to £190 million after gaining promotion to the Premier League on top of exceeding EFL FFP limits in the Championship?
Right. Well, it comes down to your favourite word of football finance, Kevin. And that word is, of course...
amortisation.
Amortization indeed. So, yes, Aston Villa have spent a lot of money on football players, but that cost will be spread over the life of their contract. So if you sign a player for £40 million on a five-year contract, the actual cost is only £8 million a year as far as the accounts are concerned. When it comes to the cash side of things, what we are seeing is that Aston Villa have two billionaire owners and they are regularly putting in large amounts of cash into the club. £20 million went in earlier this week, in fact. So that gives them the cash to deal with the day-to-day costs. Also, when Villa were in the Championship, they did sell the stadium for £56.7 million. So therefore, the profits on that will count towards FFP. Part of their training facilities was bought for the HS2 rail project, which is now looking even dafter than perhaps it's ever looked, given that I'm not sure when the next time we'll see a full train in this country. And also Villa, when they were relegated from the Premier League, and I think we've covered this in a couple of shows recently as well, they did something which is referred to as impairment, where they accelerated the losses into the years in which they were in the Premier League, because in the Premier League, you're allowed to lose £35 million a year compared to £13 million when you're in the Championship.
Hmm. Now, producer Guy, Kieran, has been paying some sort of attention this week, because this next question bears no relevance to Nobby Clark's question, but it does have the words Aston Villa in it. So producer Guy, clearly casually flicking through the questions, saw two words he recognised, and thought we'll put those together. It comes from Matthew Grisman. Matthew has a question, he says, about merchandise sales. He's heard us talk about the traditional commission model between clubs and kit manufacturers, but is intrigued about the NFL model with a business called Fanatics and how that could work here. And Aston Villa, for example, had Fanatics as a middleman rather than working directly to suppliers themselves.
Yes, so I've done a bit of digging into Fanatics, and as Matthew said, that they are involved very much in American franchise sports. And Fanatics, a couple of years ago, took over a UK company called Kitbag, which used to do a lot of the online sales. And what they're effectively now doing is that they are acting as sort of the Amazon of football kits for large clubs. So rather than the clubs having to set up their own online stores and their own distribution networks, they employ Fanatics to do this, just like many retailers now use Amazon as a means of getting stuff to customers. So they do this for Manchester United, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Villa, and so on. And I think their aim is to do that for as many of the large clubs as possible. That they by doing it from a single platform, it works out cheaper for the clubs themselves, because they just have to make sure that they send, you know, copies of their kits to Fanatics, who will then distribute them on their behalf. Clearly, Fanatics will take a small commission from that, but it will work out cheaper than the club having to have its own warehouses, its own IT systems, and its own inventory monitoring systems.
Rob Green, presumably not that one, but Rob Green says there have been several discussions on recent pods about the Citigroup and their family of clubs around the world. Is it possible for the Citigroup to buy a second Premier League team to sort of use as a gateway team or a path into Man City's squad? His theory being that big clubs would be reluctant to sell their best players to Man City, but might do so to a team that owned by Man City, where they can, you know, train and get better and then eventually move to Man City. I'm guessing that your answer is going to be no, but I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. It is intriguing. Under the rules, one owner in English football cannot own more than 9.9% of another club. So that would prevent this. However, we did see, intriguingly, in the week before Project Big Picture was announced, we saw Manchester City coming out in favour of B teams. Now, B teams, as we know, are quite common in Spain. And what happens there is that the clubs are allowed to compete in the lower leagues, but they would not be allowed to be promoted to La Liga, because there would be a conflict of interest if Real Madrid were playing effectively Real Madrid B. So this is something I think that City's owners are keen on, because at present the under-23s system isn't quite working. But then when you start to look at the small print of Project Big Picture, whilst it wasn't saying B teams was one of the proposals, they were moving slightly towards it, because a Premier League club would be allowed to have up to 15 players on loan elsewhere within the football pyramid, and up to 4 players at one individual club. So that would make it, remember we had Guy Branston on recently from Leicester, and he's the loan manager for Leicester, so that means he's doing a hell of a lot of travelling. Can you see it would cut down on, if you've got 4 players at 5 different clubs in the EFL, it's going to cut down on your amount of monitoring, but also those players would start to get even more used to playing alongside their colleagues, which would be really good use for the host club. Now, I was at a meeting earlier this week where one of the clubs in the EFL, it was a bit concerned about this for 2 reasons. First of all, if the EFL club sacked the manager, then the Premier League club would have the right to recall all of those 4 players immediately. So if you've got 4 players from Chelsea, 4 players from Arsenal, 4 players from Manchester City at a particular EFL club, they've not had a good start for whatever reasons, they sack the manager, then you've practically lost, you've lost half your squad. So that would be quite scary from the EFL club's point of view. Perhaps it could be a good thing. Perhaps club owners would have a bit more loyalty towards owners, whose average tenure these days is around about 13 months. The other thing that I did pick up from Project Big Picture, we've spoken about the Elite Player Performance Plan, EPPP, and this is being abolished under or would have been abolished under Project Big Picture, and this effectively would make it even worse. I mean, EPPP is not good, but the alternative would be that if you had players in your academy who turned out to be good, under the proposals from Manchester United and Liverpool, they would simply be able to say, oh, you've got a good youngster, we'll have him, and you get absolutely zero compensation. So under those circumstances, what's the point in having academies if your best players are automatically going to go to the big clubs and you don't get anything for developing them?
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes. Now, Kieran, I pause here just to say, you mentioned that we had Guy Branston on, who's Leicester's loan manager. And as you say, Guy told us he does a hell of a lot of travelling. You know what Guy wouldn't want to feel when he was travelling? He wouldn't want to feel uncomfortable and itchy. So, Guy, I know you're listening to the pod. You might like this next message from our sponsors. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by our below-the-waist grooming partner, Manscaped. Now, regular listeners will know that I prefer a natural garden, but Kieran has been very busy clearing the weeds from his lawn.
Indeed, I have, Kevin. If you don't want it to look like Terry Waite's allotment down below, then I thoroughly recommend the Manscaped 3.0 lawnmower. It's got a ceramic head, so to reduce the number of potential nicks, you don't want to get anything cut down there. It's got a very long life battery, lasts as long as potentially as 90 minutes if you want a longer shave. And one other thing, they've now got a weed whacker, and this is a nose and ear trimmer. It's also available, so you can keep your top of your head as smooth as below the waist.
Well, if you want your nose, ears and sack to be as well-groomed as Kieran's, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off and free shipping using the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. And next week's code is bye-bye BAFTA. I say it's a message from our sponsors, Kieran. It's a message from us, basically, on behalf of our sponsors. But, yeah, I imagine Guy's already pulled over and put that code in because, you know, that's the last thing you want when you're driving all over the country, isn't it? Is just to feel a bit uncomfortable down there when Manscaped can sort it out for you.
Exactly, yes. And neat, trim and smooth, can't be beaten.
Our next question comes from Mike Gill. Now, Mike touches on a subject we have been talking about quite a lot. Indeed, we have on earlier in this pod. Mike Gill has been watching his team, Harrogate Town, on live streaming for £10 a game, mainly on iFollow. And Mike would like our insight, and it's lovely when people say our insight. They mean your insight, Kieran, but Mike's a polite chap and he likes to include me. He'd like our insight on this as a financial model, and how much does it compensate clubs for loss of gate revenue and secondary match day spending?
It's better than nothing. It is a progressive step, I think, from the EFL to have the matches streamed. The downsides of this is that my understanding is that at most matches there's only one camera, so you're not necessarily getting a particularly good product. Listening to people complain and monitoring social media, I think iFollow, the quality has been poor in terms of losing signals, getting no audio, things of that nature. £10 is better than nothing, but first of all, you've got to strip out VAT, so you lose that. The home team keeps their money, and then it keeps a proportion of the tickets sold by the away team. This is normally based on the expected number of fans that the away team would bring. So there can be some anomalous issues. I think we discussed this earlier when Colchester, I think they were hosting Bolton, and Bolton ended up with more money than Colchester did from the match, despite the fact that they weren't actually incurring the cost of hosting the match themselves. Does it replace gate receipts? The answer is no. We have to be perfectly honest here. But it does cover a fraction of them, and a fraction is better than zero. Mm. Hopefully, there will be some progress made, some knockings of heads between the EFL, the Premier League, and government. I think the Premier League has dilly-dallied far too long with regards to this. There were simple things they could have done, such as offered to give Fulham's parachute payments, which aren't being paid this year because Fulham were promoted back up to the Premier League. They could have offered that to clubs in Leagues 1 and 2. What we now have is hostilities between the three governing bodies in football, and the government, to a certain extent, is playing them off against each other. But clubs in the lower two divisions, we're now sort of a third of the way through November. I think there's genuine concern that some clubs are going to struggle to pay the November wages. The reintroduction of furlough, however, will help. And this is a positive step. We will see more and more clubs using furlough, especially for non-playing staff.
It's clearly Aston Villa Day, Kieran, because our next question comes from Liam Reynolds. And Liam Reynolds wants to know, if he purchased an Aston Villa shirt with a player's name on the back, does the player get a cut of the profits, i.e. royalties?
The simple answer to this is yes, he would, Liam. Under normal circumstances, when a player signs a contract with a football club, there will the contracts these days aren't a single sheet of paper. They do go into the various commitments from the club and the various commitments from the player as well, one of which will be in relation to what's referred to as intellectual property rights.
Yeah.
Now, if you are Cristiano Ronaldo, David Beckham, Neymar, Lionel Messi, and so on, those are worth an awful lot of money because people want to be associated with success. Those clearly are Galactico players in terms of their reputation and status within the game. And therefore, they will be entitled to a proportion of a shirt that we sold with their name on the back. If you are a left back playing for Burton Albion or Morecambe, the chances are you might not have that embedded into your contract because just from a practical point of view, there's not going to be that many fans buying shirts with your name on. So it is something which is very much geared towards the elite. But for a club such as Villa, if I was Jack Grealish's agent, it would have been something I would have been very keen to have embedded into the contract.
Yeah. If you are Burton's left back, I can only apologise. It must be terrible for you listening to this pod of a Monday, trying to relax after a hard day's training, only for Kieran to tell you you're not likely to sell many shirts. Our next question, Kieran, comes from Austin. Just Austin. I'm guessing Austin didn't include a surname for whatever reason, although I do like to think it could come from the entire town of Austin, Texas, who have spent the week saying, I'm not asking, you ask it. Austin says, with the next few seasons set to be the hardest yet in the Football League financially, is now the time to bring in a draft system for free agents to secure survival and sustainability of hungry players and deserving Football League clubs?
I think this is a really intriguing question. If we take a look at the draft question, so the draft system as it operates in US sports franchises, what happens there is that the college sports, college sports teams, they effectively put their players up for draft, and then the clubs bid for them in reverse order. And this is one of the great things. This is one of the amazing democratic things about US sport. If you finish bottom of the NFL, you get first dibs the following season in the draft. And that's try to ensure that we don't end up with clubs who are completely adrift. The US sports organisers don't want something similar to La Liga or the Scottish Premiership or the Bundesliga, where you know that the champions next season are going to be from one of two or three clubs.
Yeah.
So that works quite well. That wouldn't work, however, in my opinion, as far as a draft system for English football, because the academy players are already at clubs. And if we're talking about, and I think Austin made reference to clubs, to players who are without a team, then their agents would have been touting them around and trying to get in contact with managers and coaches elsewhere. And that's part of the agent's job to say, my client's free. So I'm not sure of the practicalities. I think it would be intriguing. I think it would be potentially, from a Sky Sports point of view, they'd love it. But I'm just trying to work out the logistics, and I just don't think that would quite work.
Oh, yeah. Imagine how excited Jim White would be on draft day. That would be all dear. In fairness to our Scottish and Spanish listeners, I think, Kieran, quite a few of them will be saying that in years to come, you can increasingly add the Premier League to the list of leagues where only one or two clubs are going to win it. James Audley has an interesting question, talking of lists of clubs. See, even subconsciously, Kieran, I'm linking questions together. That's not bad with a champagne hangover. Does Kieran have a list of clubs, says James Audley, that outside the top six, whose facilities, history, stadium, catchment area and recent accounts would make them ideal for a sugar daddy or mummy to buy make money on and achieve success. I mean, I can think of one in Southeast London, Kieran. It must be ripe for that sort of takeover.
Yeah, but we've spoken about Millwall recently, Kevin. So let's just forget them for the moment. Actually, Palace are on my list. So, but I think the prime clubs, as far as potential investment is concerned, you want a stadium which is significant in size. So Newcastle United, you know, they have to be that it's a one club city. They do have history and heritage. They do have this proud tradition of player development. You think about Alan Shearer, Paul Gascoigne, Bobby Robson being the manager. You know, it is a very proud club. So I think they would be ideal. Looking at London, looking at, you know, ticking boxes. Well, we've got West Ham playing in the London Stadium.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's got a capacity of 60,000. It has the potential, should somebody have the resources to want to take it forwards, to genuinely be competing with the other large clubs in London. But at present, you know, the owners are putting in some money, but clearly not at sugar daddy levels. Sunderland, if you're looking for a cheaper option in the lower leagues, again, big stadium, big history, I think they would be ideal. So those would be the type of clubs I think that sugar daddies would be looking at if they want to move into something which has the existing infrastructure, as opposed to, you know, I understand that the plans at Palace is to build a new stand, yeah, to take the capacity up from, yeah, was it 25,000, add on 7,000 or 8,000 there. If that was the case, then given that they, to a certain extent, have a monopoly of that catchment area, they do have genuine appeal.
Yeah, if James was to ask me this question, the club I always come up with is Plymouth Argyle, who one day, surely, will get into the Premier League. And with that huge catchment area they've got down there and an already large, loyal fan base, surely that's a club that's going to make money for somebody somewhere sometime, isn't it?
Yes, in terms of being able to buy the club very cheaply, and you could quickly develop the stadium. I think it would be an intriguing option. And I've got a huge amount of affection for Plymouth Argyle, because it was a Plymouth Argyle fan who came up with the idea of Fans United in 1997. I wouldn't have a football club to support without Plymouth Argyle fans being fantastically insightful.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Kieran, because I've got a huge amount of affection for the city of Plymouth, as it happens, for various reasons, mostly close to your Russian reasons, but there you go. Mark Middling. Mark Middling is a great, I like this name, Mark Middling. Now, Mark has read a few academic articles which use the UEFA coefficient as a metric. I wondered exactly what this is and whether it's important to clubs financially. Now, that's Mark wondering that, not me, although I also wonder, because I'd never even heard of it, to be perfectly honest. So what is a UEFA coefficient, Kieran, and does it work as a metric?
The UEFA coefficient is based on the progress of an individual club over the last five seasons in UEFA competition. So, therefore, if you take a club such as Bayern Munich, what have they done? Well, they won the Champions League last season. That will be so many points. Then how did they get on in 2019, 18, and so on? And I think this is sort of, it is weighted towards the most recent season. And the aim here is that if one of the giant clubs within Europe either doesn't qualify for the Champions League or performs very poorly, they will still receive a fair, you know, a decent payout from UEFA itself. So that's how it works on an individual club basis, but also it works on a country basis, because at present we all know, and we just sort of accept, that England's going to have four teams in the Champions League, as are Spain and Germany and Italy and so on. Other clubs get two. Some clubs only get one. Some clubs have to go through the preliminary rounds and things of this nature. Well, the number of clubs that you have going into individual UEFA competitions is determined by the nation's UEFA coefficient. So Although, if we take, I think, Scotland's a prime example, although Rangers fans will be sniggering like hell at present because they've made a very good start to the group stages of the Europa League and Celtic have had a terrible start, it's actually probably in UEFA, in Rangers' longer-term interests for Celtic to make a bit more progress because Scotland are presently 11th in the UEFA rankings. And I think, if my calculations are correct, that means that they're going to have two clubs in the preliminary rounds of the Champions League next season, as opposed to one. Now, that's in the interest of both Celtic and Rangers. So, it's a nerd's delight. It's spreadsheet heaven when you are doing your calculations. And Mark's right. Yeah, it is a genuine metric.
Oh, good. That's what was making me the most anxious, Kieran. I wish you'd said that at the start. It would save me a couple of minutes of real nail-biting anxiety. Our penultimate question comes from Tom McCormick. Thank you for your question, Tom. There's been a lot of talk, says Tom, about clubs taking legal action when they've been relegated as a direct result of points deduction. However, as many players have relegation wage drop clauses, could they have grounds for a class action lawsuit for lost earnings caused by a points deduction which had nothing to do with them?
Right. I got in contact with our legal friend, Thomas Horton here, who runs the I think he's the Football Law on Twitter. And Thomas very kindly gave me a proper legal answer as opposed to our pub lawyer answer. He said highly unlikely because there is no obligation from the administrators of football towards individual players on a collective basis or on an individual basis. Having said that, sometimes the clubs need to be practical in issues of this nature. Now, whilst it wasn't a relegation issue, you do recall a few months ago, we had quite a big story, as did UEFA had a big story, when they banned Manchester City for 2 years from competing in Europe. Now, had that been upheld, remember, last season, Manchester City finished second in the Premier League. So under normal circumstances, they would have qualified for the Champions League. If we take a player such as Kevin De Bruyne, now, again, we don't know the exact details of a player's remuneration package. And frankly, I don't really care. It's his business with the club. But he is alleged to have a £1.5 million bonus should Manchester City qualify for the Champions League. Now, if they were kicked out of the Champions League by UEFA, Manchester City could say, well, yeah, oh, Kevin, sorry, mate, you're £1.5 million worse off. From a practical point of view, what is Kevin likely to do in terms of toys and pram if City said that to him? Mm-hmm. And therefore, the club would say, if they've got any sense, Kevin, this is completely outside of our control. As far as we're concerned, we finish second. Although we're not obliged to pay you that money, we are doing it as a goodwill gesture.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm childish, Kieran, but I like that answer because it had the word Kevin in it a lot. That's the level of intellect I'm working on this pod at the moment. Speaking of administrators, takes us to our last question. And our last question comes from Leslie Ackerley. Hello, Leslie Ackerley. Leslie describes herself as a concerned football fan in her 60s who's listened to our pod for some months and has become increasingly concerned about the difficulties faced by League One and League Two clubs. In particular, the fees charged by administrators and lawyers that you have talked about, which are astronomic and smack of parasites bleeding clubs dry. I like Leslie. Why do the EFL, Leslie asks, not work to arrange terms with a firm or firms of administrators who will do the job at a fair price instead of using clubs as cash cows? And I think that's something that Wigan fans would like to answer because, you know, some of the numbers you threw around during Wigan's administration were, you know, nostalgically eyebrow raising. And I think Leslie's got a good point. Why can't the Football League have their own set of people, administrators, that they send in to clubs when they have to?
Well, if the EFL did that, then first of all, who is going to be this firm of administrators? Presumably, you'd have to go to an existing firm of accountants and say, would you like to be our in-house administration team? The firms of accountants will turn around and say, okay, going rate's £350 an hour, take it or leave it.
Right.
And if the EFL say, well, we don't want that, they say, well, that's fine. But you end up having to go into the bargain basement area of administrators. Now, the bargain basement, I suspect, will be still £250 an hour.
Right.
And are you necessarily getting a better deal? I'm not so certain. From a legal point of view, administrators are appointed by the company itself. So this is UK law. So I think that there could be legal consequences if a third party, such as the EFL, were to appoint an administrators at Wigan when the EFL aren't in need of protection themselves.
Right.
From the legal point of view, there is actually a way of reducing costs because instead of going through the traditional courts, there is an agreement now that clubs and the administrators of sport in the UK, they tend to use the services of an organisation called Sports Resolutions. Now, Sports Resolutions, the advantage of using them is, A, they have more expertise as far as settling sports disputes. They can normally quickly assemble a panel, so therefore you can get resolutions sorted quicker than going through the court system, which can be quite slow, can be quite turgid. And my understanding, it's a wee bit cheaper than having to use a barrister and using the traditional courts of government. So there is a cost saving through using some of the vehicles which are available to clubs and to the administrators of football in this country.
Leslie, I'm sorry about that. That probably wasn't the answer you wanted. If it's any consolation, welcome to my world. We spend a lot of time before and after recording this pod with me going, well, why can't that happen? And Kieran just kindly and gently explains to me why certain things can't happen. So it's not just you, Leslie, trust me. That was our last question. If you have questions to ask us about any aspect of football finance at whatever level of the game or whatever part of the world, you need to email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, I shall hand you over to Kieran for a short farewell.
Well, thank you, folks. Stay safe. And one of the ways you can stay safe is by using a ceramic head on your pubic hair trimmer, such as in the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0. Bye-bye.
The Price of Football. Price of football.